It's the second hour of 3D here on 102.5 The Game. Willie Donick and special guest star Steve Lehman from News Channel 5 Sports Department. Darren McFarland off today. Derek Mason on leave of absence. And we press forward. We got a great show. Had a great first hour for you. Coming up at noon today, Tim Hasselbeck will join us. And we will talk NFL with him on the day before a big game for the Titans as they take on the Pittsburgh Steelers. I'll be heading out a little later today with the Predators. They'll get ready to take on the Minnesota Wild tomorrow night. So the Predators and the Titans will be going on basically at the same time with a couple of big road contests. So, Steve, college basketball has started. And it started off with
some big stories.
And I said this to Rick Byrd yesterday. We had him on in the wake of their huge win over Vanderbilt. Had a great atmosphere over at Kerr Event Center.
Awesome.
And you know, I'm not from Philadelphia, but one thing that I always thought was cool was, you know, the Big Five that they used to have. And they a lot of times they would play all in the same building, right? The old Palestra. But we've got a little vibe of that going on in Nashville these last few years. Vanderbilt's been good. Middle Tennessee's been excellent. Belmont's been very consistent. Lipscomb is coming on now. So you've got, you know, some programs. TSU's coming on.
Tennessee State with Dana Ford.
So everybody's bringing something to the table. A lot of them play each other. I think it makes college basketball fun to watch locally.
Oh, it's awesome. Absolutely awesome. And it's great to be able to have the rooting interest in all these teams as they come up and in different conferences. I mean, you've got some of the OVC teams, but Lipscomb and the A-Sun, they can all win their conferences, basically, and we would cheer for that.
Yeah, and so that's a little bit how it is in the Big Five to a large degree. Right?
And this year, by the way, we've got some teams that have a chance. I think Lipscomb's going to be a contender in the A-Sun. Middle Tennessee, obviously a favorite in Conference USA. Belmont, a favorite in the OVC. So there's some chances that we could have a bunch of teams doing some things later on this year.
Well, with that in mind, we bring on Kermit Davis, head coach Middle Tennessee. They're 1-0 to start the year, and they've got Belmont coming to town tomorrow night. So another big game on your docket for a Thursday. So, Coach Davis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, appreciate it, Willie. Good to be on, and you're right. We're looking forward to playing a really good Belmont team. It's one of the best defensive teams I've seen them have.
Yeah, Coach Byrd said that. He said, this might be my best defensive team that I've had. And, you know, they held Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt, I think, hit two of their last three threes when the game was pretty much in hand for Belmont, but they were 2-for-20 to start the game for three. So Belmont has figured out a way to get some pretty good defense. That's a pretty good shooting Vanderbilt team, on paper anyway.
It is, Willie, and that's been the most impressive thing about Belmont to me personally. You know they're going to start shooting the ball better with their percentage from three, and about half their shots are from three. They haven't shot a great percentage, but they've guarded so well to hold Vanderbilt to 34% shooting. You know, tonight they didn't shoot the ball great from the perimeter. That shows a team that can win a lot of different ways.
So, Kermit, how do you feel about this whole the local college basketball vibe? You've been here for a long time, but you know, with Darius Garland signing with Vanderbilt State, we keep one of the local stars here. I love how this is unfolding. Year after year, it seems to get better and better because you have a lot of teams that are fun to follow.
There's no question, Willie. And I just think it's, you know, it's great that Vanderbilt obviously come to our place and then they'd go to Rick's place. And, you know, we did a 2-for-1, so we're going to go to Vanderbilt for 2 years. And we all get that. But the more that, like, we play Murray State or we play Tennessee State and we play Belmont, you know, it's hard in the heart of SEC football to create interest in college basketball, especially in November, early December, and these games do. I mean, if it, you know, the Kerb Center was sold out, you know, tomorrow night we'll have a great crowd here versus Belmont. We hope a lot of Belmont people will come too. And I do. I think the college basketball, the interest level, they want to see those games.
It's got kind of a high school state tournament feel to it to me when you have the fans from the two different schools getting together for these local games. And for your players, Coach, I would have to think it's easier to throw out the schedule and say, hey, we got Murray State on Monday night. You guys know them and what they can do. Then we got Belmont coming to town. Then we got Tennessee State on Saturday. I would imagine that's an easier sort of rollout to your week and getting guys' attention than if you were just playing, you know, some directional school this time of year.
Yep, Steve, it's a good point. And plus, you think about you got a Murray State, a great crowd at Murray State, you know, and then we go to Tennessee State Saturday afternoon at 3. So all fan interest game, great budget games, you know, that you're not flying all over the country to play. is great for school. You know, teams aren't missing very much school and playing those games. So there's just a lot of pluses, you know, and then I hope, you know, since Bruce has left, we haven't really gotten Tennessee to play. I guess we played it one time in the NIT. So we sure hope that we can even rekindle even Tennessee and Memphis back on the schedule.
That would be great for sure. Middle Tennessee basketball coach Kermit Davis joining us here on 3D. Your team goes up to Murray State the other night. That's a difficult place to play. You come away with a win. You obviously have some veterans that have been to the NCAA tournament, won games in the NCAA tournament, but what did you learn about your young guys or new guys the other night in that atmosphere with the way they responded?
The one thing, and obviously we're a work in progress for sure, but what we did learn is this. Our four veteran guards who have all played great parts in us winning NCAA tournament games, Dixon and Potts and Simpson and Johnson, they competed hard but had a really kind of poor offensive game. And so it was good that we could go on the road and beat a good Murray State team without those guys at their best offensively. But Nick King, a new guy, had 31. You know, he's averaging about 24 a game early in the season, but he's a real skill stretch four. And had a guy, David Simmons, who was a new junior college player that really gave us a lot of toughness. And then I was really proud of Carl Gamble, the kid that's been in our program. He's played behind Ja'Cory and Reggie and those guys, and really played well for us down the stretch.
That was the most impressive thing to me, Kermit, that your guards, who you count on, Potts and Davis, or Dixon, you essentially didn't get production from them offensively the other night, yet King and Gamble and Walters and those guys got you over the hump.
It did, and so I really didn't think going in the game those four guys could play like that offensively and we still have a chance to win against a good Murray State offensive team. But we kind of did with Belmont. We hung our hat defensively second half. We guarded so much better. Not very good defensively the first half. Held them 23 the second half. And we shot a great percentage from the free throw line. So found a different way to win, you know, and having 19 turnovers, which was a poor stat for us also.
Kermit Davis with us, Middle Tennessee head basketball coach. Coach, you've had great success with transfers coming in, and now you've got Nick King. He starts off great with 31. What is your process like to get guys like that acclimated? When I was at Vanderbilt, we had huge success with transfers. Transfers were a big part of a team that ended up winning the SEC championship in 1993. Bruce Elder, Billy McCaffrey, Chris Lawson, all guys that had transferred in and had to sit out an entire year before they played. But so three of the five starters on an SEC championship team, all coming in from other places. You've had similar success here these last couple of years. What makes it the second go-around for some of these guys the right place at middle?
Yeah, you know, I bet you Willie on that team and those three guys you mentioned, I bet you they were all high-character guys. I mean, I bet you they were guys that, you know, they still put winning in front of everything else. You know, we've had two players of the years, Dindy and Ja'Cory Williams, that had to sit out a year, and I think they both helped them get involved in the program and the culture of winning and how we go about work. Nick King's a little different, really. He's our first grad transfer where he comes and plays immediately. And so his process, we had to speed his process up, and demands were a lot higher on him early, practices and different things, just because we knew he had to play a vital part for us to have some success early. But, you know, transfers in college basketball, it's a part of the culture. We hate to see it, but everybody's taking advantage of it.
You mentioned him as a stretch four, and that's a term that I think more and more people are saying. We were talking to Rick Berg yesterday. He loves to have the guy down on the post that can operate with the post moves down there. Evan Brads was that guy for years. He's always seemed to have a guy like that, but he says it's harder and harder to find guys who can really operate out of the post. And so now you're hearing a lot more guys with that term stretch four, where maybe you can post up, but also they can go out and face the basket.
Well, you know, the NBA, but really Europe brought it in about 15, 20 years ago. You know, all those guys started coming over and said, God, these seven-footers, they all make threes, they all hound the ball. And it seemed like the NBA started evolving. You can watch an NBA game, and there may be only five balls thrown right at the post in a true post-up series. Now, you'll have these hybrid fours, stretch four guys that can get involved in the post, and Belmont's guys can too. But if you can't go out and make a three or at least make a 17, 18-footer and be able to stretch the floor to open up the lane for driving, I tell you what, it's almost like the NBA won't even look at you anymore.
Yeah, Coach, you can blame me for that. Us TV guys, we don't show a lot, don't show a lot of nice post moves and baby hooks.
but it is the truth, and I think like I said, Europe brought it in. When we got the European influx, how many years ago that's been, and yeah, all the skill
Dirk
work
Nowitzki
they
and
did.
Guys like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think it would ever cycle back the other way, Kermit?
I don't think so. I think there will be post-up games, but all those guys, we just signed a 6'11 kid from Albany, Georgia, Carlos Curry, who's really a talent, and he's 6'11", 245. And, I mean, he in a high school game, he'll make two or three threes in a game. He's skilled. You know, but always tell them, if you're 6'11 and all you can do is shoot threes, you don't bring much value. But now if you're 6'11 and you can lead your team in rebounding and make a three, now you've got great value. And so you can't just be a 6'11 guy that plays like a 6'4 guy all the time.
Well, you found a bunch of guys who have some value and have really helped your program get to the next level, back-to-back wins in the first round of the NCAA tournament. How has the expectation level changed? I know you guys have always had high internal expectations, but how has it changed the last couple of years when you start a season based off of how you finished the last season?
You know, Steve, I think we fight like crazy to create expectations, and that's good. I can just sense, especially this year, the national attention, you know, for us has been almost more than the local attention. You know, even in our local newspaper, you know, it seemed like we've had more national people talk about our program, and that's a good thing. And so I just think we all fight every day trying to create the expectations. I think it's a great thing. You know, the players and coaches, they don't get caught up in it, but it's sure great for maybe selling tickets for your fan base or creating your brand to help in recruiting. But we all know we got to go through the day-to-day process. But it's been fun. I'm sure just like Rick can tell you, a fabulous job he's done. I mean, gosh, taking it from an NAIA to creating a national brand in basketball like he has at Belmont. And so it's been fun just in the 16 years that I've been here to see our brand increase and people really notice your players and they notice your basketball brand.
Because of that brand, and now you mentioned national, people are paying attention right from the start of the season, not just in March in the conference tournament. When you looked at this schedule this year, you've got a big game tomorrow night against Belmont, which could go a long ways for you later on in the year. Are you now more conscious when you schedule non-conference to try and get some more of those marquee games that pad that resume to give you maybe a chance to have an at-large bid later on in March?
No doubt, Steve. In putting together the schedule, that's the only thing that goes through our mind every year. I mean, it's just that, you know, last year our non-conference strength of schedule was in the top 25 or 30 in college basketball. I really feel this is the toughest one that we've had because, I mean, we're playing three SEC teams. We go to Hawaii, and I think there's six of the eight teams that are NCAA or NIT teams last year, USC, Miami, New Mexico State, Davis, all those teams. But then what's so critical is we're so fortunate is we can play a game like Belmont. And I think Belmont's going to be a top 50 RPI just watching them. I mean, I just think, I mean, there's a lot of basketball, and they may say the same thing about us, but Murray State, I think, is going to win a lot of games. Tennessee State, who beat us last year, you know, at our place. So there's a lot of good quality games that you can play in our area. And then we got Florida Gulf Coast twice, which they may be one of the most talented teams we'll play all year.
Wow. That's a team. That has been a fun team to watch over the years, hasn't it? My goodness.
It has.
People know who they are now. You know, a few years ago, it was like Florida, Gulf Coast. What?
Now they're,
you know,
Dunk City.
Yeah. Dunk City. Well, Coach, it's great to have the season underway here. Congratulations on the win at Murray. Good luck tomorrow night against Belmont. We'll be paying attention.
All right, Willie and Steve, thanks. Appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Kermit.
Right. Kermit Davis, another good squad on paper going in. Two straight years to the NCAA tournament. It's becoming, you know, very consistent to talk about them in the picture for Conference USA titles.
It's amazing to me the job he's done down there of just steadily building a program. And it was a process. You know, they went from being just a good team to being a team that contended every year in the Sun Belt, by the way. And then they had some issues. You remember this, Willie, where they were winning the regular season, but they couldn't get over the hump in the conference tournament.
And, oh, yeah.
And we were asking the questions of
losses.
Yeah. When are they ever going to get into the NCAA tournament? This team's too good for this to keep happening. And then all of a sudden they get into Conference USA, and it's like they take it to another level, literally. And now they're dominating in that league in the regular season, and they're winning the conference tournament, and they've gone into the NCAA tournament now and won games. And, you know, even think about the last 2 years. 2 years ago against Michigan State, it was the biggest upset ever. Nobody expected it to happen, and it did. Last year, people expected them to go in. A lot of people thought they would beat Minnesota, and they walked in and did with the expectations on it. So they've managed each part of this process very well, and Kermit Davis deserves a ton of credit for that.
Now, I didn't get a chance to see these games last night because, obviously, I was at Bridgestone Arena, but a couple of big marquee games. They're trying to kickstart, I can tell, because there are a lot of people that say, remember, the season didn't used to start in college until after Thanksgiving.
Right.
Thanksgiving weekend is when you would, by rule, you couldn't start until before that. Now you start earlier, so they're trying to get some spotlight games going. They had two of them last night, Duke against Michigan State, Kentucky against Kansas in this State Farm Champions Classic. So Duke beats Michigan State 88-81, and Kansas holds off Kentucky 65-61. So anything come out of those two? I mean, you have all these new guys in this day and age of college basketball that you have to learn about. So any takes from that? I don't know if you got to see much of it, or because I didn't see any of it.
I watched mostly the Preds, but I did watch some of it. And the things that I thought, and especially going in, Michigan State and Kansas have the most returning. So to me, those were the two best teams in the country entering the year to me, just because of what they had returning. You talk about Graham and Langford and those guys and Malik Newman on the perimeter for Kansas. You've got Miles Bridges for Michigan State. Those guys, you know what they are. They're known quantities. When Duke hits the floor, they have the most talented roster in the country, but a lot of those guys are young. A lot of those guys are new. And so what I think I learned last night, same thing for Kentucky, is those new guys, they're ready for the college game. And I know Michigan State, Kansas, who won last night against Kentucky, Michigan State lost to Duke. Those teams are going to be there at the end, but I wanted to see how those young teams matched up, and clearly Duke's there already, the number one team in the country. They won last night in impressive fashion, and the way Kentucky hung with Kansas, that tells me you give John Calipari, as is tradition, 2 or 3 months with those guys, and they're going to be a force to be reckoned with.
And this is the luxury you have in college basketball that you don't have as much of in college football. And it's a different model because you don't stockpile the talent like you can in college football, where the idea is sure. you have guys ready to jump in and produce right off the bat. But you can tinker with your roles. You can you know, be willing to lose a game if you have to, even if it's, you know, not a good-looking loss, as long as you have it together by January 1st, February 1st in particular. And then, of course, peak in March.
Your talent in college basketball is also looking to leave after their first year, yeah. Unlike in college football, too. So you don't have time to, you know, redshirt them or try to get them to work into the system. You've got to figure out a way to do it on the job. But, yeah, I mean, I think this is the fun part about college basketball is the fact that you get Kentucky and Kansas playing. You get Michigan State and Duke playing. These preseason conference tournaments, you get some great matchups. It's hard to break away your focus from football sometimes, but you can get some really good games early on in the season.
But what's the challenge for Kentucky? And this would be, because they didn't look very good in their first game. They did end up winning. But remember, people were going, what's going on? Utah Valley? Or who are these guys?
Well,
is that even a Division I team? You know,
and then they played Vermont, which is a similar type of deal.
Yeah. And the best Kentucky teams, I think, that Calipari's had, he's had at least two or three guys who, maybe even if they weren't star players, they were guys who were glue.
Mm-hmm.
They could come in there and they had been through it. And they could help the marquee freshmen that were going to be one-and-done guys that everybody knew. Now, you look at that roster who played last night. I mean, it's an entirely new team. It really is.
Unless you pay a ton of attention to college basketball recruiting, you literally need a program to watch a Kentucky game at this point in time.
So that is tough. I don't care how good these freshmen are.
And that's the genius of Calipari, right? Is the fact that every year he can take all these new guys in and figure out how he wants to play with them. And it might be a little bit ugly or nerve-wracking early on if you're a Big Blue fan. But by the time it rolls around to SEC play, and certainly by the time they get to March, look out.
Final thing I want to hit you with college basketball before you go back, and we'll yo-yo back to football here. But the news with Darius Garland for Vanderbilt. I just think you can't undersell how big that is for that program. I think they'll be okay this year. I think they'll be competitive, maybe to the bubble. I'm hopeful that if the pieces fit, they can be good this year and not have a big drop-off from making it last year. But the direction of the program now with Garland, and I think he's kind of a magnet that's going to lead them to another recruit or two here to pick up before they take the court next year. And they've got a couple of guys sitting out this year, transfers that I think will be good veteran players for them around those guys. Next year is going to be off the charts in terms of local excitement, I think.
I agree. They've got a long way to go this year. I think that we saw that the other night. I mean, Belmont was just clearly the better team. And I don't care who you are in the SEC and where you're playing that game, when you walk into a non-Power 5 school and you just get beat around like they did, that's troubling. So they got a ways to go this year, but the future is bright. They've got some talent already on the roster. I think Larry Austin's addition is somebody who's going to play very well there. You've got some other guys in the backcourt that are going to be good. They've got to find some more meat inside, I think, than what they have right now. But Garland's a great player. I mean, he's the highest-rated recruit Vanderbilt has ever gotten in the so-called rankings era. And there's a couple of other guys that they're in on, and I'm hearing positive things about it. We'll see if they can land them or how soon they land them and what this class ultimately can be. But it has the makings to being a top five, top 10 class, and those are the types of classes in basketball that if you can put a top five class together, you can be good immediately for the same reasons we're talking about Kentucky. Because in basketball, unlike football, you don't need the maturation process. You don't need years in the weight room. If you can play, you can walk in and play.
Mm-hmm. No question. So exciting times coming. When we come back, we'll yo-yo back to the Titans a little bit more as they get set to take on the Steelers. We'll touch on a few other things as well. Don't forget Tim Hasselbeck coming up at high noon, as he always does on Wednesdays here on this show. Stay tuned. This is 3D on 102.5 The Game. 11:30 is our time. Willie Donick, Steve Lehman, hanging out here on 3D. Steve, you've been heading to the Titans practices, and it dawned on me when I was sitting in the stands. I took my son to the game on Sunday to watch the Titans' dramatic win over the Bengals. Shouldn't have been that tough. They probably, I thought in the first half, the Bengals were ready to just lay down. They were, yeah. Titans were all over them. But the Titans kept giving them little windows of opportunity to hang in there. And the Bengals, to their credit, they would jump back in there. And all of a sudden they had the lead at the end of the game. Like, well, how in the world are they losing this game?
About three or four mistakes made it a game. I mean,
huge mistakes.
Blown coverage in the first half on the touchdown pass to LaFell. That tied the game.
Yeah.
You come right back up and scheme up a beautiful play, which, by the way, I've heard a ton of people complain about play calling and those sort of things. Play calling wasn't the issue, son.
No.
Execute a couple plays, and it's a totally different game. Rashard Matthews drops an easy touchdown. You had Corey Davis fumble through the end zone on a play where, at worst, you're first and goal from like the 1.5 yard line. And then you have a missed miss tackle combination that leads to an A.J. Green touchdown. It's essentially four plays that takes it from being like a 30-14 Titans game to all of a sudden you're leading or losing in the fourth quarter. Now, to the point we made earlier, the best thing you can say about the Titans at this point of the year is, while it hasn't always been pretty, and they've maybe let a few teams like the Browns or the Bengals hang around longer than they should have, when everything is on the line, they've come up with the play more times than not, and that's why they're 6-3 and in first place.
So maybe their mystique grows a little bit more as a result of that, or they take a step forward in a way. So, but you've been in practice, and it dawns on me as I'm watching the game, I'm like, boy, the defense, there is a difference when you have guys. It's like with Kyle Turris added to the Predators. You just visually, you see everybody in the right spot. You're saying, now you've got weapons. So I see Adoree Jackson coming on. Logan Ryan has been solid, mm-hmm. I think. Cyprian's back in there. They've got both defensive ends, knock on wood, healthy right now. But the defense is healthy. And when everybody's there, it's not a great defense. But relatively speaking, at this stage of the season, to have everybody participating in practice is an amazing feat.
It's remarkable. And it hasn't been the case to this point of the year. I mean, last week, You had DeMarco Murray out. You had Delanie Walker out at times. A couple weeks ago, you had
we had the hamstring
Mariotti,
gang
obviously.
Every week. What's going on with the hamstring?
Everything. Yeah. Corey Davis missed the first half of the season, essentially. And for this to be the shortest week of the year with less than 100 hours from the time you walked off the field Sunday to the time you kick off in Pittsburgh on Thursday night, to have everybody on the practice field yesterday, to me, is nothing short of remarkable.
Now, as our guest Jim Colony pointed out earlier, it can change in a heartbeat, especially sure. when you play Thursday night. I don't know if there's scientific evidence that you're more likely to get hurt when you're on less rest, or guys haven't healed up as much, and maybe you're going to great lengths to play with pain, and that makes you more susceptible. I don't know if there's anything that can be proven, but it's been a scary trend right now. It's like everybody. All these Thursday games, there's been some prolific injuries like Richard Sherman's last week.
Sure, and I don't know.
That's what you worry about.
I don't know if there is any evidence in terms of you're more likely to have a catastrophic injury in that game, but I can tell you that these Thursday night games over the last few years have just been bad football. You're just not watching the best the NFL has to offer, and I don't know if that's, to your point, guys not being healthy enough coming back. I would have to think it's hard to game plan in a week like this. I mean, I know the coaching staff essentially ran out of Nissan Stadium on Sunday, went right back to the office, didn't even bother looking at what just happened, the sort of corrections you always hear about on Monday, and went straight into game planning for the Steelers. So when guys showed up at noon on Monday, as opposed to getting treatment and then starting their weekend,
it's
they were ready
you.
To put in a game
affect
plan.
You.
It's got to be different.
And you throw the travel on top of it.
Yeah.
For the Titans, not for the Steelers, and that maybe that's where the Steelers get an advantage there.
Which, by the way, I looked up yesterday. Since 2006, that's when the NFL started the Thursday night package. And remember, initially, it was just post-Thanksgiving. And then in 2012, they expanded it to be the full season package. But the road team is about 20 games below 500 in that time. And since 2012, when they went to the full season package, the road team is, I believe, 38-49 in that stretch. So it is definitely a bigger challenge to do this and then take the road for one of these games.
Wow, that is interesting. One thing that gives me hope, and there's a number of things to do, but you know, Corey Davis back in there, as you mentioned. The other thing I saw that I wasn't sure I would see on Sunday was that Marcus Mariota is now willing and ready to run again and run effectively. The 51 yards running, he was moving very, very well. And you just never know with the hamstring, right? I'm holding my breath every play going, oh, you know. But he looked like he was running normally. I still don't see DeMarco Murray in full gear. And he gutted it out and he made big plays for them. But so you wonder, and it sounds to me, everything he says, it's like, hey, I'm just going to have to deal with this. I'm going to get through. I'm going to play. I'm going to find a way.
And he does.
And he does. But Mariota, to have that weapon of him being mobile, that helps everybody else on the field on offense.
No question. By the way, Murray actually wears a shirt under his pads on game day that says find a way, or on the back it says or fade away. And I think that's a perfect illustration of who DeMarco Murray is he's just a consummate professional that no matter what happens, what he's dealing with, he figures out a way to get himself ready to go. Even if he doesn't practice the entire week, show up on Sunday and be productive.
That touchdown to win it
was a great play.
Incredible. I mean, it doesn't get the national, you know, that's not a featured highlight in a lot of places, but that's a play that not a lot of people make. And he made it by half a football, but
sure. the
difference in him making that play and not is everything. Who knows what happens if that game goes to overtime? Who knows?
The Bengals defended that play perfectly. They defended the goal line, made sure the Titans could not complete a pass in the end zone. So he's your safety valve. He catches the ball at the 4-yard line. There's three players essentially between him and the goal line, and he's able to make the guy who comes out to get a miss and then barrel through and find that crease to get in the end zone. That's a terrific play. As you mentioned, it's not necessarily a highlight play because it's a 7-yard touchdown, but it is a terrific play that is what I'm talking about. When the chips have been on the line, this team just seems to have a belief now which you haven't been able to say about the Titans for a long time, but this team seems to believe that if you give us a drive with Marcus Mariota or you give us a drive with the defense to come up with a stop, we're going to get it done.
So how much do you think now that they will start using Mariota more as a runner? Because as you get deeper into the season, it's kind of like, hey, it's time to go for it. Whereas a few weeks ago, it was very evident from the start of the game. He's not capable of running. He is not going to run the ball. But now that he's done this, do you think we'll see a little bit more of it, especially when you're facing a challenging task and maybe haven't outgunned the Steelers? You figure the Steelers are going to score some points
sure. In
this game. You're going to have to come up with probably somewhere in that neighborhood of 30 points to win this game.
The Titans are going to have to be more efficient than they've been. They've moved the ball sort of throughout the season, but at times, like last week, Rishard Matthews dropped touchdown, Corey Davis fumbled through the end zone, they haven't always capitalized on some of these drives. You can't leave points on the board Thursday night in Pittsburgh, and for that reason, and I think for the rest of the season, with the fact that this team is now healthy, you're going to see everything to the offense. Is that Marcus Mariota on designed runs? Maybe. Are you going to see more from both Murray and Henry? Are you going to see them both in the game at the same time? I think you will. Are you going to see more from Adoree Jackson? I think you absolutely will see him on the field, both as a threat and as a decoy, as we saw last week. And I do think the more he gets on the field, Corey Davis will change the complexion of the passing game for this team. All of that together, I think, means they can be more dynamic here in the second half of the season.
I've been waiting for it. If that happens, then you really got something. I think that is what I think you asked in the first hour, is there another level?
Yeah.
I mean, just going the way they've played all year is probably good enough to get into the playoffs. But to get into the playoffs and beat somebody, or maybe to outrace Jacksonville, who has, as you said, just as easy, maybe an easier schedule than the Titans have, then that's what it's got to be. It's got to be this offense finding a whole nother level, running the ball even better, and then having guys like Davis and some of the other youngsters up at a notch, you know, find another groove, you know, understanding and big play capability.
Well, think about it, Willie. When we looked at the season at the beginning, wouldn't you have thought that the strength of this team was going to be all the weapons on offense and how dynamic they were going to be and the fact that they were going to put up 28 or 30 points a game? And your question mark was going to be, well, just how good is that defense going to be? How good is the secondary going to be? Will the special teams be improved this year? The special teams stepped up in a huge way for this
team.
Big
time. Much better.
The defense is much better. The secondary is much improved. The question mark to this point is, can the offense stop being so inconsistent? And that's an amazing question that we're frankly asking at this point compared to what we thought we'd be asking heading into the season. And I think that's why there is a belief that they can turn it around here.
I thought it would be a top 10 offense. I thought
me too.
For it to be good, for the team to be good, they would need to be a top 10 offense. They're right now 16th in Football Outsiders. They're fourth in the running game. And we still don't feel like the running game is maybe quite as powerful on paper
sure. Right
now as it,
we
as
saw
it was
some
last year.
On We've Sunday. Seen,
well, they ran for 180.
Right.
You know, so that's pretty good.
That's a great day.
And even if it's been sputtering here and there and it hasn't always been great, it's still fourth relative to everybody else. But the passing game is where that next level red zone efficiency, finishing, I mean, just not dropping a touchdown pass in the end zone or not fumbling on the one, that would help.
Sure.
Right there. But so it's there. There's room for growth.
Absolutely. And to me, it all starts with the offensive line. This unit was supposed to be one of the two or three best offensive lines in football. And last year, I believe they were. But this year, they have not been able to sustain the blocks long enough to have this running game be as dominant as you would want it to be. And because of that, I think it's hurt the passing game. This team is at its best when it's grinding you out on the ground and then the play action game comes off of it. Marcus Mariota is excellent in the play action game and throwing the ball middle of the field. That to me is all predicated off of how well you run the football, because if you can pull those safeties up in the box and still chunk off plays, now all of a sudden that passing game and those lanes open up in a big way for your quarterback. If you can't, it changes what the defense throws at you. So to me, maybe the biggest key to them being able to take the next level is, can that offensive line, and by the way, Quentin Spain, one of those guys who is healthy and was back at practice yesterday, he should be back in the lineup Thursday night in Pittsburgh. Can that offensive line get back to the level it played at a year ago?
I'm excited to see what happens tomorrow night in Pittsburgh. Of course, I can't watch it live. I'll be doing the Predators Wild game, which is a big game in and of itself, so I have to get the DVR going.
That's right.
For that one, or I might be peeking at a TV. I might just be peeking a little bit here and there from the intermissions and stuff. When we come back, we'll talk a little college football. The football rankings came out last night. Vanderbilt has got a very interesting two games ahead of them, and we'll explain what we mean coming back here. As poor as they played on Saturday, they still have hope. Unlike Tennessee, who, you know, they're turning the page. They're moving ahead. In 2 weeks, the Vanderbilt-Tennessee game, to me, has a lot of intrigue, even though everybody's like, they're so frustrated with their own programs right now, they don't want to think about it. But if you can clear it, if Vanderbilt can find a way to win on Saturday, wow, there's a big opportunity in Knoxville the next week. We'll come back, talk a little college football next. Don't forget Tim Hasselbeck at noon here on 3D, 102.5 The Game. The college football playoff rankings came out, and of course, as I say every week, it's insignificant. But, of course, they like to throw it out there, and it has you sort of projecting. That's the one thing it does, is you project what it can mean.
It's great for talk radio.
I guess it is. I try not to worry about it. Like, if I'm Wisconsin, for example, and they're number five, you can't stress out that they have you at number five. It doesn't mean anything. Just keep winning.
Right.
They will get in the top four, I think, if they complete the season undefeated. There's just no way. It's going
to
happen.
I had someone call in last night on Sportsline on News Channel 5 Plus to ask exactly that. They were sort of outraged. The teams with losses were in the top four ahead of Wisconsin. And I just said, chill out for a second. I think they're being punished because they haven't played anyone really yet. Their best wins are Northwestern, Iowa, which are fringe top 25 teams. But they're going to have that shot. They get Michigan this week. If they win that game, that probably gives them a little bit of bump, and they obviously would have to win the Big Ten championship game. If Wisconsin goes 13-0 and is the Big Ten champions, they're getting in the Final Four. That's just it. So, yeah, don't freak out at this point.
The question that I have is Auburn right now. I think that's with two losses, of course, one of them is to Clemson, and theoretically, Miami could beat Clemson. And so Clemson could have two losses. But the comparison of perhaps, potentially, and this is, there's so many different things. This is still a lot of games. A lot of games that can change things. I mean, we're not talking about Notre Dame this week.
Right.
Notre Dame was being talked about for 3 or 4 weeks. It's like the year that Ole Miss and Mississippi State were on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and by the time it was crunch time, they were way out of the picture.
Sure.
Way out of the picture. But Auburn, as a two-loss team, could be compared with Wisconsin undefeated. That's a potential scenario.
Yeah.
Two losses to zero losses. And Auburn could have an argument, we have a better resume.
Well, the only way that happens, though, for Auburn, I think they would get in. Because that would mean they have to beat Alabama in the Iron Bowl, and then they'd have to go beat Georgia again in the SEC Championship. So I see no way Auburn gets left out then, but I don't think it would be at Wisconsin's expense.
I don't think so either.
Because the way I look at it is you look at the top seven, I think everybody controls their destiny. If Alabama wins out, they're in. They may be the one team that could afford a loss. Like if they lose to Auburn, that's where it gets maybe interesting. If they go 11-1, don't win the division, don't have to play Georgia, where's their strength of schedule and that loss put them? That's curious to me. But Clemson and Miami play each other, so that to me works itself out. I think probably only one of them ultimately get in. It's the winner of the ACC championship game. I think Oklahoma, if it takes care of business and wins the Big 12 championship, I think it's in. I think Wisconsin, if it takes care of business, it's in. I think Auburn, if it can beat Alabama and go to the SEC championship game and finish with two losses as SEC champ, I think they're in. So I think you get through the top six. And who's seven? Sorry.
Right now seven is Georgia. Yeah.
And Georgia, if you get back to the SEC championship game with one loss and you beat Alabama or Auburn, I think Georgia's in. So to me, the top seven right now all control their destiny.
This is a fun one, and I know we're not the first to bring this scenario up, but Bama does the Ohio State dance from last year. Lose to Auburn.
Right.
You have one loss. You don't go to the championship game. You're not the champion of even your division. But you are, I guess that would make them 11-1 sitting there. Really don't have great wins when you get down to it. What do you do? Are they in? I mean, that's an ultimate test. Because Ohio State got some benefit of the doubt for being Ohio State.
Yeah. Alabama will get that benefit of the doubt.
But they had to win over Oklahoma in Oklahoma last year. Alabama doesn't have that.
No, they don't. Now, here's the other part of that is they tried to. They tried to have that game because they scheduled Florida State.
They
Remember,
did.
That was supposed to be the greatest opening weekend game in the history of college football. And Florida State looked like a good team that night. But you lose DeAndre Francois and the rest of the injuries that have taken place to the Seminoles, they're not the same team at this point. And that's been proven with their record. So how does the committee view that game? Is it who they actually beat on the field on September 2nd or whatever it was? Or is it what Florida State's done the rest of the season? That, to me, is interesting how they look at it and how they view Alabama as a whole, because injuries to Alabama have made a difference too. If you looked at Alabama a month ago, they looked unbeatable. Now, if you look at them and you watch that game on Saturday night, there are some remarkable holes for a Nick Saban defense.
They look
right
human.
Now. Yeah.
They look human. And this is where it gets very arbitrary. And you have a lot of ex-coaches on the committee right now trying to evaluate. I'm sure they're going to leave the analytics to others, and their strength is going to be the eyeball test, preparing as if they were preparing for them as an opponent. But. For example, because I can see the argument. Hey, when they took the field against Florida State, Florida State was number three. But that was only by, an arbitrary set of people evaluating talent. Is Florida State only whatever their record is now because they lost one guy, their quarterback?
Well, they've had a bunch of other injuries too, but fair.
But so it's arbitrary. You say, they tried to schedule somebody good. That's only half the battle, but what is the real value of that win? It might be an essential question.
Well, that's the big problem with preseason rankings altogether, is everything at that point is just a guess because no one's done anything. But I guess you have to have a starting point.
Also, this point was brought up. We had a gentleman on who covers Georgia last week, and he was talking about Clemson – almost getting a mulligan. I mean, the coaches are saying, hey, they lost to Syracuse, but their quarterback was hurt. Well, in theory, Georgia lost their quarterback the first series of the first game or first quarter, whatever it was.
Sure.
They just happened to have a really good backup quarterback. So this is all part of the equation. You can't just penalize a team for having a good backup quarterback, nor can you completely excuse a team because they can't beat Syracuse with their backup quarterback.
Yeah. I think you see different takes from the committee on all of it. You want to really fire people up, though? What's the chances Ohio State sneaks back in? Because did you notice the bump they got this week by pummeling Michigan State? And, I mean, that's a good win for them, and they've got some good wins. Obviously, the Penn State win's a top 10 win there. But they've got two losses. Still, they're going to have the opportunity down the stretch here to beat Michigan on the road at the end of the year, and then the Big Ten championship game against Wisconsin. If you get that game, which is probably going to be a top five victory at the end of the year, I certainly see a scenario where it doesn't take a whole lot of movement at the top where all of a sudden Ohio State's right back in that conversation of do they belong in as number four or something like that.
And they won it, won the whole thing the first year they did this by not only beating Wisconsin, but beating them so impressively that it gave them the bump. Remember, the couple times Ohio State has gotten in on a debate, they were the last team in.
And
they were number four.
And one time they went on to win the whole thing, and the other time they got humiliated.
Right. And they could be right in that bubble again. Ohio State, the bubble Buckeyes. Could happen again.
But just mention Ohio State and Alabama too, maybe less so in this part of the country because there's so many Alabama fans here. But those two teams, you just mention their name.
There's bias.
People automatically have bias, and especially when you're talking about that, would they get in? If Alabama loses to Auburn, doesn't win the division, and they're sitting there with one loss, the debate about Alabama, oh, man, you could do radio shows for days on that. Same thing with Ohio State.
All right, last thing this hour before we go back to the pros and talk Tim Hasselbeck. Give me your thoughts. Does Vanderbilt have any chance of beating Missouri? Because if all of a sudden they surprise people and do – man, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in Knoxville the following week. But if they don't, it's kind of like, oh. I remember in 2000, and I think it was 2005, Vanderbilt started 4-0. They got a field goal blocked by Middle Tennessee with 10 guys on the field that would have put them at 5-0. They don't win another game until they upset Tennessee. And they hadn't beaten them since 1982.
Right.
It was so exciting, but it was so, at least in my mind, it was bittersweet because it didn't give them
wins. Yeah, I don't know. The thing is, and you'll remember this, they're in the exact same position that they were a year ago.
Yes.
They're 4-6. They need to win the final two games. And arguably last year, with Ole Miss being one of them, you had a tougher task. And frankly, Tennessee being one of them, you had a tougher task.
A 9-win Tennessee team.
So, theoretically, they've got an easier job in front of them, but the momentum's so different. They started 2-4 last year. They kind of righted the ship middle of the season and caught a wave at the end and played really well to get in. I just don't feel that way about them right now. To go 3-0, to lose 6 of 7, there's no momentum there. Now, that's not to say they can't do it. They've been in this position. They've experienced it before. I think they're going to score points each of these next two weekends. But that defense, man, for something Derek Mason is so good at, he just doesn't have the guys right now. And I don't know, especially against Missouri. I have no idea what will happen in Knoxville. But Drew Lock looks really good right now. And that Missouri offense can put up some points. And I just don't know if Vanderbilt can score enough to keep up with them.
I worry it's a fit. It's not an effort thing. I don't even think it's a scheme thing, honestly. I just think it's a physical strength, speed thing that is hurting them on that defense. When we come back, Tim Hasselbeck joins us. We talk NFL football here on 3D.